another TYT interviews another excellent person to interview. Look at this, Carrie Ann Mendoza. She's a reporter who was on the ground in Gaza during the latest incursion. She has a fascinating story of her life, let alone the travels and travails she's been through. She used to actually be a management consultant for banking and local government, etc. She dropped out. She's covered the Occupy movement. She's obviously covered the Middle East. Carrie Ann, welcome to the Young Turks.
That's great. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Now, first of all, just before we get into Gaza, I assume you were making decent money as a management consultant. What in the world possessed you to drop out and become a reporter? You crazy, dog?
A little bit. I think the way I put it at the time was, I always said if the revolution happened, then I would show up. So when the Occupy movement began to take off across the world, the one place that I wanted to be was there. And once I'd had that incredible experience and I was writing every day, a daily blog that called Scriptonite Daily, which took off, and I just didn't want to go back to the office after that. It felt like this was where I needed to be, covering the stories that weren't getting covered in the mainstream media. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
So why? Don't you think that the mainstream media was incredibly fair to Occupy?
You must be grinning when you're asking that question. No, I didn't think it was fair. And, you know, it covered Occupy in the same way that it tends to cover most of the most important issues of our societies, which is, you know, the spectrum for debate is so narrow. That you never really get to ask the really important questions. It's what your show does really well, is actually just expands that narrative so that you get a real debate about possible solutions to the problems that we're facing.
Yeah, you're quite right. I was grinning rather broadly. So now on to Gaza. When did you get there? When were you on the ground? Was it before the incursion, during the incursion? How did that go down?
So I arrived in Gaza on the 15th of August during the 5-day ceasefire. My intention was to cover the humanitarian effort that was required to recover Gaza from the then 6-week assault that it had faced. And we went down to Khuzar in the south and Shajaya, which was particularly hard hit. And then several days in, we'd come back from filming. And we find out through Twitter that Israel has announced that the ceasefire is over and they're about to attack again. So that was what I came into.
You know, that's a tremendous amount of courage. I honestly, to say the least, would be hesitant to go into Gaza in the midst of any of that incursion, ceasefire or not. So what did you find on the ground? What was your sense of what had happened? I want to talk about both sides here, but first, in terms of the population of Gaza?
I mean, Gaza has a population of 1.8 million people, and a million of those are children. They're under the age of 18. So before I go any further, that's something to bear in mind. I went expecting to cover a war, and what I covered really was a genocide. It was nothing short of a massacre. One of the districts that I visited, Khuzar in the south, this is a town of about 12,000 people. And I spoke to one woman who was woken at 4 o'clock in the morning. Her whole neighborhood was being gassed. Israel dropped gas on the neighborhood of Khuzar. This has been documented by Human Rights Watch. Then you've got some people choking, you know, some people fleeing, some people dying, and then F-16s and Apache helicopters and tanks began to fire missiles and shells to this densely populated residential neighborhood. And then the people who hadn't died from the gas or the shelling then tried to make it out of there's a single road that leads out of Khuzar to the north. And Israel had set up sniper positions at the border of the town and essentially was shooting people like fish in a barrel. And I spoke to one woman who was carrying her baby child out of the town at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and all of this noise and terror, and an Israeli sniper shot her baby dead in her arms. And then told her to drop the child or she would be next.
So, Carrie-Anne, a bunch of things you said there that are really draw my attention. First, let's talk about gas. You said generally gas. Can you be more specific about that? What kind of gas were they dropping?
We don't yet know what, we haven't yet had official confirmation of what gas had been used. But if you look, groups like Human Rights Watch and others have documented the use of gas in Shijaya, which is East Gaza City, and Kuzar in the south. Those are two confirmed cases where we know gas was used, but we don't yet have confirmation of what the nature of that gas is.
So I know that U.S. troops have used white phosphorus in the past, which human rights groups are very concerned about, but we say it's for just to cause confusion in the enemy and to also light up the battlefield so we can see it better. Say they see it worse, we see it better. But obviously, that does some damage to the civilians. So it's a question as to whether it should ever be used. I think I would answer it by saying no, it should not be used. We don't know if that's what Israel used in that case.
I would agree with you.
Right. Now, on to the snipers for a second. Now, look, Israel says, no, we're looking for Hamas and we're looking for terrorists. So I'm positive that they would object to the characterization of shooting a baby and telling the mother to drop the baby. Are they lying? How can we confirm whether one side is right or the other side is right? Because I'm sure they would vehemently object to that characterization.
I think one way that you establish the credibility of a source is you look at past claims and whether they stacked up or not, and you examine the evidence on the ground. In terms of the past credibility of spokespeople for the Israeli Defensive Forces, the IDF, they've an absolutely appalling track record. The UNRWA, UNRWA, the UN organization which is sheltering Palestinians, just on the 23rd of August countered another Israeli claim that the reason that UN shelters were being bombed by Israeli aircraft was that Hamas fighters were sending rockets from within the school or nearby. And Israel officially retracted that after the fact. And the UN confirmed that on the 23rd of August, that that had been retracted. But what happens is Israel will give one argument at the time, and then, you know, weeks, months later, issue a very, very quiet retraction. And no doubt the same will be the case of this. And also, when you look at the people who are confirming this happened, you have independent journalists like myself, you have human rights organizations, and you have the Palestinian witnesses on the ground, many of whom were able to film and take photographs of this as it was happening. So the case is pretty clear. You know, we have more than 2,000 killed in this attack, at least 70% of them confirmed by the UN to be civilians. So the case against Israel's argument here is absolutely watertight, and people need to be in no doubt whatsoever that what took place over the 7 weeks of Operation Protective Edge was outright an attack predominantly on civilians.
So that gets to a larger question. Look, on the issue of the statements, that's the old Pentagon trick invented by the US. You say one thing on the day of when everybody's paying attention, and 6 weeks later you say the reality after no one is paying attention. Kind of like how Osama bin Laden hid behind one of his wives, which then they said a couple of weeks later, and no, he didn't, right? But everybody thinks that he did because of the original statement. Now, it doesn't really matter. Nobody's got sympathy for bin Laden anyway. That was just gratuitous use of the strategy. So I understand how that strategy works in general. Now, you use the word genocide in your original description, coming back to the issue of what happened in Gaza. And you describe shooting civilians, gassing civilians, etc., right? I think that a lot of Israel supporters, including friends and colleagues of mine, would be absolutely incredulous at that. Because they would say, wait a minute, now look, we're trying to stop Hamas from firing rockets on Israeli civilians. And we've got every right to do that. We got to go get the tunnels. We got to go get Hamas, and we've got to degrade their ability to attack us. But why? Why would Israel hit civilians? It doesn't make any sense. So when you say that, they don't believe you. So why would Israel hit civilians? Why would a sniper hit that baby? It's So explain that to people who would be really, really incredulous about that.
Well, I think the first thing to say is people may well look at me as a freelance journalist and say, well, what do you know about genocide? But there was recently a letter by 327 Holocaust survivors and their descendants published in Haaretz, which is Israel's oldest daily newspaper, which called this a genocide. And I think, you know, if you're willing to look somebody in the eye who's a Holocaust survivor and tell them they don't know what a genocide is when they see it, I think that's a pretty brave person. And secondly, in terms of Israel's right to self-defense, I think what we have to stop, you know, people keep talking about Israel's right to self-defense, but Israel isn't defending itself. Israel right now is defending its occupation. It has almost 2 million Palestinians locked in the world's largest open prison. Those are the words of the UN, the world's largest open prison. It's an 8-meter high wall. It continues to restrict the calories and the basic supplies of food and other things that come into the Gaza Strip. You know, these people are living in inhumane conditions because of the blockade that that Israel has maintained on Gaza for now 8 years. And in order to stop any resistance to that egregious and illegal occupation, yes, they have to use force. But that's not self-defense. That's using force to prevent legitimate resistance opposing an illegal military occupation of millions of human beings.
But Carrie-Anne, so they would say, look, you said it wasn't a war, but of course it's a war. I mean, again, this is the Israeli position here that I'm stating for you so that we can get a sense of back and forth here on,
of course,
right, on what really happened. They would say, look, we lost over 60 soldiers in Gaza when we brought in ground troops. We had heavy fighting between Hamas and the Israeli Defense Forces. They're building the tunnels. The tunnels into Egypt, you can argue, might be to smuggle in not just bomb-making stuff, but food, et cetera, right, and goods that they need in Gaza. But the tunnels into Israel are clearly for terror purposes and not for trade. So, of course, there's a war here, they would say.
And they would be absolutely wrong. And that's one of the biggest issues with the mainstream media coverage and coverage full stop of this situation. We call it the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I spoke to Gideon Levy, who's an award-winning, esteemed veteran journalist in Israel, about this matter. And what he said, justifiably, was we never called apartheid South Africa the sub-Saharan African conflict. You know, we didn't call the French occupation of Algeria the French-Algeria conflict. We saw them for what they were, which is an illegal occupation of one power over a people with no army. And that is the context with which we need to view Israel today. Israel is illegally occupying vast amounts of land. It's occupying millions of people, and it is keeping them under total control. And Benjamin Netanyahu and various other leaders within Israel have gone on the record to say that they have no intention of ending this illegal occupation. And as long as they do so, as long as they continue to, as they do, conduct mass arrests across Gaza and the West Bank to deny people of food, to deny people of water, of electricity, of just the right to live in peace and freedom and self-determination, so long as Israel continues to do that illegally, there are 77 UN resolutions against various elements of Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, as well as individual acts. As long as that persists, then any of what Israel is doing, including its attacks on civilians, cannot be described as self-defense in the same way as the, you know, the attacks of apartheid South Africa on the or the black population could not be considered self-defense or war.
So I see what you're saying. You're not saying that there wasn't a conflict, that Hamas didn't fire back. They certainly did when there were ground troops inside Gaza, and they obviously have fired rockets into Israel. But you're saying that, are you saying that that's a legitimate resistance of the occupation?
Well, international law says, actually, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, that a people that are occupied illegally have a legitimate right to self-defense. Now, what that looks like, we can certainly debate. But the fact is, you have 2 million Gazans trapped behind an 8-meter-high wall, which Israel controls. Israel controls the land, the air, and the sea of Gaza. And Norman Finkelstein, who I'm sure you're well aware of, a prominent Jewish scholar in America, was speaking to media just recently, and actually he wrote that, you know, the purpose of the Hamas rockets, which aren't rockets, by the way, they're projectiles, very, very small payloads, no targeting systems, homemade. Theodore Postel of MIT referred to them as upgraded fireworks. Essentially, the purpose that Hamas have with these projectiles is to bring forth Israeli soldiers into the Gaza Strip so that at least they can have some form of resistance, some form of conflict, to sort of try and fight for their self-determination. They really do. It's really hard to understand, I think, for people until you've been to Gaza, until you've stood there with people who, you know, are being slowly starved. 95% of their water has been made undrinkable by Israel. You know, drones are constantly in the sky. You know, every 1 or 2 years, Israel blows the place to pieces. There's 77 UN resolutions, not one of which has been enforced. You know, the whole roadmap for peace is completely stalled. And Israel is every day ratcheting up the occupation. Just that stranglehold around Gaza gets tighter and tighter. So people almost feel like they can't breathe. And that creates desperation. And when you remove any hope from people that by following the rules, that by attending the peace summits and the talks, if you remove hope that those roads to peace are valid and will deliver, then you create a dangerous situation where people without hope, all that's left is resistance by any means necessary. And that's where some people in Gaza have been driven to. And the way that we create a peaceful, secure Israel is by creating a peaceful, secure life for Palestinian people, because as long as there is no justice, there will be no peace.
Now we get into my personal opinion. I think the occupation is completely and utterly unacceptable. And I understand the frustration and I understand the conditions that you're describing on the ground. I think that the resistance is, I don't want to say futile, that's totally wrong. I think the manner in which they carry out that resistance is not only futile but counterproductive. Because the idea of drawing Israel into Gaza to fight in the streets, yes, you know, Hamas might have killed 60 some odd Israeli soldiers, but 2,000 innocent Palestinians, or mostly innocent Palestinians, died along the way. So I fear that that is a terrible strategy, not just in winning the war, because there is no war, as you describe, it's incredibly one-sided, but also because it hurts Palestinians in the process. But then that opinion would lead me to this question. Are there other forms of resistance, and have they shown any success whatsoever? Peaceful resistance, diplomatic resistance.
That's the issue. They haven't. I mean, that's the problem, is that, you know, if you look at the difference between the West Bank and Gaza, is a classic case, is we say, oh, what do the Hamas rockets achieve? Well, actually, all that's happened to the West Bank over the last 10 to 12 years is that more and more land has been taken. And while Gaza is a giant prison of 1.8 million people, Israel has turned the West Bank into tiny prisons. So you have these 8-meter walls surrounding each village in the West Bank, completely cut off from each other. And, you know, just in the last couple of days, Israel has announced it's taking another 1,000 acres from Bethlehem. It's just appropriated it. It's just about to take another 500 acres from Hebron. So they're just being annexed. And actually, what Hamas and an armed resistance has achieved is it has actually forced Israel, despite the vast asymmetry of the situation, it has forced Israel to some limited concessions. And if you look at, well, what are the alternatives? Really, there are none. If Palestinians have no right to protest peacefully this situation, they're just shot down. You know, in the last 3 weeks, you've had more than 10 Palestinians shot at peaceful demonstrations, three of them children. You know, this is not a situation in some democratic country where you can say, it's okay, we can explore diplomacy, we can protest, we can write letters and petitions. This is a truly brutal military occupation where Palestinians die every day. Life is incredibly cheap in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel doesn't stop killing people when our news cameras move away. People are continuing to die right now in the Gaza and the West Bank. And so to suggest that they, you know, kind of put out an olive branch and try and do things peacefully, they have tried this for decades. This is 60 years old now, this situation. And all they have seen is further land lost, further rights lost, and more dead.
Carrie-Anne, I understand that. And I think the most discouraging part of the United States' reaction to all of this is that when there are peaceful protests, and even if you minus the shootings, which is a weird thing to leave out, Israel usually uses the protests as a way of rounding up Palestinians, but then you're rounding up the most peaceful Palestinians, the ones that could actually, and perhaps that's exactly why they do it, so that you remove what could be an effective resistance if it was pursued in a more peaceful and in a mass way. They round them up, and the U.S. Has no negative reaction to that whatsoever. They just view that as ho-hum, business as usual. When the Palestinians pursue diplomacy through the United Nations, the U.S. says that it's preventing the peace process, which is literally the most absurd thing I've ever heard. When we foreclose their peaceful and diplomatic alternatives, then we leave only one alternative, and it's an alternative we say is awful and hideous. So we have to look at ourselves as to what alternatives we are offering the Palestinian people for a meaningful way of getting
Absolutely.
Out of that
the
occupation.
The fact is, Palestinian people are exhausted with having to endure this occupation, these wars. You know, a third of people in Gaza lost more than three relatives in a single incident in the last 7 weeks of this conflict. That's the scale of devastation that the people of Gaza have gone through. You know, 20,000 homes have been destroyed. A quarter of the population has been made homeless. You know, there is not a people on earth that is more ready for a just peace than the Palestinian people. But what they need is a partner for peace, and they don't have one. Netanyahu is absolutely not interested in creating any type of Palestinian self-determination and any rudimentary look at the situation about, you know, if you listen to the way he speaks, he's on the record. Anyone who believes that Netanyahu is a peacemaker looking to, create a scenario where you have a just solution for the Palestinians and the Israelis is living, frankly, in cloud cuckoo land. And that's what I was told over and over again within Israel before I even got to Gaza. And in fact, one of the things I was most surprised by was that what people were telling me is essentially the two-state solution is dead.
Yeah.
Like, it's over.
Yeah, I hear Israelis saying that, not just the peaceful Israelis that want the two-state solution, who are disgruntled and dismayed at the developments, but the right-wing Israelis saying, yeah, no, that's it, two-state solution's over, we now just have the land. And that's the scariest thing I've heard yet. And so that means, no, we will have endless war. And it's not just scary for the Palestinians. I think that if you're an Israeli, you should be scared about that, because these guys are declaring a permanent war against the Palestinians. So that's not good for either side. Now, to Netanyahu's strategy, it appears that if they are, let's not say targeting civilians, but are indifferent to civilian casualties during the Gaza incursion, one of the possible reasons they might be is because they think, well, if we beat these guys down enough, they'll know that they have been conquered, and then they will get rid of Hamas, because they will view that Hamas has done this damage to the Palestinian people. And I've seen Netanyahu talk about that particular part of it over and over again. So now, you've been on the ground, do the people of Gaza now have any inkling of saying, well, okay, Hamas did this damage, so we're against them, or has it had the counter effect where Hamas has become more popular?
Yeah, it's completely counterproductive. Obviously, support for Hamas is surging. But, you know, Israel always seeks to delegitimize whoever is the authority for the Palestinians. You know, when we had Yasser Arafat, Israel was helping to build mosques in Gaza and helping to encourage Hamas to provide, a divided voice for Palestine between Yasser Arafat's group, the PLO, and Hamas in the late 80s. Remember, Hamas have only been around since 1988. Israel was killing and occupying Palestinians long before Hamas came along. Then Israel says, well, you know, if you'd only stop, you know, being with Yasser Arafat and pursuing these methods, then we would grant you peace. And so you have Mahmoud Abbas, who is a completely rejects all violence, has turned up in good faith to all peace talks, you know, even offering massive compromises to Israel in terms of offering up East Jerusalem and various other compromises, has produced zero result at all. And the separation barrier was built around the West Bank, which is that 8-meter high wall, which imprisons people, more land confiscated. And then the excuse was, well, we'll talk to Abbas and Hamas when there is just one government. We can't talk to two parties in Gaza and the West Bank. So in April this year, Hamas gave up its stance of refusing to recognize Israel and joined a unity government with the Palestinian Authority, Abbas in the West Bank. And what did Israel do? Did Netanyahu's government say, this is extraordinary. We now have a unified Palestinian voice which recognizes the right of Israel to resist, to exist. No, he immediately broke off talks with Abbas and said he wouldn't deal with him while he was in a unity government with Hamas. And now you have essentially Israel putting massive pressure on Abbas by enormous land confiscated to the West Bank, mass arrests, more than 100 Palestinians arrested, homes being destroyed. There are even these things called skunk trucks, which Israel is deploying, which are, you know, literally firing sewage at Palestinian homes and streets in the West Bank at the moment. All of this designed to break, essentially, the unity government and have Abbas back away from dealing with Hamas or face these types of consequences from Israel. You know, Israel is not a peace partner. This is another thing that really has to change about the narrative, is that, you know, we're constantly hearing, you know, Netanyahu and Israeli spokespeople to the Western media presenting this very moderate, very civilized, very war-weary tone of voice. What the Israeli government's story is entirely the opposite.
All right, one more question for you, Carrie-Anne. You know, I have this, some might call naive dream, that we can do peaceful protests, but they have to be massive. And most importantly, they have to be on video, because otherwise they'll get arrested, they'll get shot, and no one will know, no one will care, right? But that now, because of the advent of YouTube, social media, etc., that if there were peaceful protests, massive ones inside the West Bank, crossing border crossings, not border crossings into Israel, but within the West Bank, the checkpoints, and they just try to walk across the checkpoints, doing civil disobedience, a la Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, etc. Maybe they could even...
Sadly, we already have those videos. That's already happening. There are peaceful protests in the West Bank en masse. There were 50,000 people protested in the outskirts of Ramallah, Kalandia checkpoint, when the Gaza conflict began. What did we hear about it? It's completely silent. And even though it's on social media, that's not enough to change. What we're actually saying in that, it sounds amazing and inspiring, and I understand why people say that. But the reality of that is we're saying to Palestinians, you know those guys who keep killing you every day? Well, what we'd like you to do is just completely unarmed, walk towards their death, and there might be a few hundred of you killed, but it might change public opinion in the West, and you might get a better peace deal out of it, which is just obviously patently absurd if you're, you know, in the real world talking to real human beings, you know, in the West Bank and Gaza, because they're being killed every day anyway. So there's no hope that if a few more of them are killed, maybe we'll care more. you know, maybe there'll be a chance for peace, because actually public opinion around the bulk of the world acknowledges that the real victims in this situation are the Palestinians. They're the people that are being illegally occupied. So that that consensus already exists. What doesn't exist is the political will in the United States and Western Europe to back that public view with action. And that's why you have 77 UN resolutions against Israel, which are unaddressed, because to have those resolutions become a reality would mean that Israel would have to stop its occupation. And the only way to do that is with a UN Security Council resolution, which the US and the UK or France or whomever continue to veto each and every time it comes. So in terms of where, you know, where do we go from here? An end solution, everyone I spoke to, actually now, if you see most commentators say that the real end game of this is a one-state solution. There has to be a one-state solution that recognises all races and religions, a secular state. They have the same rights, they have the same responsibilities. And that's what's missing, is Palestine doesn't exist today. You know, there is no Palestine. There is only really Israel, and a portion of its population who happen to be Palestinian are living in ghettos created by the state, confined, where they will remain.
Yeah.
Unless the world acts and stops that occupation.
Right. There is a contradiction there that Israel unfortunately cannot resolve, which is that if you have a one-state solution, which some of the right-wing Israelis now say they want, you cannot have a secular state. So, and they don't view that as a contradiction. They say, yes, it will be a Jewish state, it will be one state, and the Palestinians then presumably have no rights. And so I guess the third part of that makes it a contradiction is Israel is a democracy. It's not. If you have a one-state solution, it either has to be secular or it is not a democracy. That's the situation they find themselves in if they're comfortable with
that. That is correct. Yeah, Israel has a choice to make. It has a choice. It can either be a Jewish state or it can be a democratic state. It cannot be both, because so long as it remains wedded to the idea of a Jewish state, it has to refuse the right of Palestinians to return, who are refugees. There are 5 million of those. It has to continue to confine large chunks of its population in Gaza and the West Bank, where they have no voting rights and no legitimacy. It has to continue to oppress its own people. I mean, many people who are watching this show might not even realize that within Israel, there is actually no such thing as an Israeli. So in Israeli citizenship cards are demarked by race. There are no Israelis within Israel. So an Israeli passport for external consumption would have nationality as Israeli. But within Israel, people operate on citizenship cards. And those cards, the nationality is race-based. So you're either Jewish, Arab, Circassian, or Druze. And whatever race is on that nationality section of that card determines your rights, it determines your restrictions, determines whether you can attend university or not, which career path you can take. So Israel internally is a racial apartheid state before you even get onto the subject of the Palestinians. And a lot of the people I was speaking to in Israel were saying actually the best thing that could happen for Israel is a one-state secular solution, because it would actually free groups within Israel to have a much greater level of freedom than they today enjoy.
All right. You know, one of the things I learned from this conversation, which is a really fascinating conversation, Carrie-Anne, I already know the U.S. and international media is doing a fairly terrible job and certainly a biased job in covering this, at the very least in how they normalize the occupation. I realized through this conversation one of their biggest faults is the lack of coverage non-war gets. That war gets tremendous coverage, thereby incentivizing violence on both sides, but certainly on the Palestinian side. But peaceful protests get almost no coverage, whether there's mass arrests, whether there's shootings, etc. So the Palestinians then make a rational decision, one that I still disagree with and wish they wouldn't make it, and I think is ultimately counterproductive. But they say, all right, well, if our plight is going to be featured all over the world if there is violence and war, but it is not going to be featured if we go through peaceful and diplomatic solutions and the daily grind of the occupation continues, well, then we have no choice but to go through a violent solution so that at least people pay attention as opposed to ignoring a 60-year occupation. So, or, you know, depending on how you characterize it, you could say that it's almost 50 years. So that's a very important problem for the media. I'm not sure that they recognize it as such.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the really is crazy. When you actually go to Israel and Gaza and you see the difference between the scenario actually in real life and the conversations that are happening in the mainstream media within the United States and within the UK, I mean, no wonder so many of our population feel like this is a complicated issue. You know, it's portrayed as almost like a religious-based conflict. It's portrayed as, roughly equal. It's portrayed as intractable. It's actually really, really simple. You know, one group of people has illegally occupied another. They need to stop that. That's it. That's the end of the story. But obviously, what makes it complicated is that country doesn't want to stop occupying that land, and the most powerful nations on earth don't want it to either. All of these media efforts have to go into justifying that for us.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. Carrie Ann Mendoza, thank you for joining us on The Young Turks, and thank you for being courageous enough to go on the ground and to cover it. No matter what the coverage indicates. So thank you for joining us.